UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. My name is Pradeep Mundre, and I'm your host for today. I remember the first time I wrote my first scientific paper, probably about 12 years ago, and I was trying to publish this, and it was just a large cohort series on duodenal adenomas. And as a young doctor, I did not have enough skills to write the paper. After months and months of corrections, I finally completed writing my paper, and I was pleased, I was happy, I was ecstatic. And I thought, oh, all my efforts are finally paid off, and I'll soon be a first author publication in my name in one major journal. And this was 12 years ago. And 12 years down the line, this paper is still not published. It's still lying somewhere electronically in my computer. I thought by that time, most of my hard work was done, but I didn't realize that that was just the start. And publishing a paper is not an easy process. I think, you know, completing to write a paper is just the beginning. Publishing is this constant process of submission, rejection, corrections, resubmission to a different journal until you're able to publish this. And that experience, it was so much different from the last major publication in Lancet Gastroenterology, which I did a couple of years ago, if I remember correctly, where I was able to complete the entire research and publish from start to finish in 3 months. And that too in a major high-impact journal. And I was wondering what changed in those years. What was the difference? You know, did my attitude change? My approach to these things changed? And this is exactly what I want to focus on in this episode. I want to focus on the very aspect of scientific publishing, how things have changed over the years, and how is this evolving in the future. So to talk about this, today's guest is Professor Joost Drent, Professor of Hepatology at the Amsterdam University Medical Center in the Netherlands. We all know Joost from his omnipresence at the UEG. He's the Vice President of UEG and soon to be President in the future and the Editor-in-Chief of the UEG Journal. Joost, I just want to start by going through your own journey into the world of publishing. I mean, you know, what inspired you from the beginning of your career to your current position as the editor of UEG Journal?
Well, what inspired me is actually curiosity. And let me take you back to the days when I was a medical student. At that time, there was no internet access, and I had a subscription to the British Medical Journal, which is a weekly, as well as a Dutch medical journal. And I read in the BMJ a letter to the editor about a rare patient with a very rare syndrome. But to me, the terminology of the diseases looked off. So I remember the piece actually in the Dutch medical journal about the same disorder, but that classified this syndrome completely differently. So I thought, hey, these pieces actually conflict. So I wrote a letter to the BMJ highlighting the obvious discrepancy. And to my surprise, the letter was actually published. And I had my first English language letter in the literature. And actually, you can trace back in on PubMed. But then actually the problems or the twist actually started, because the authors of that original letter came back to the BMJ with a rebuttal to my letter. And there I was at a very difficult spot, because I did not know what to answer. So I went actually back to the author of the paper in the Dutch Medical Journal. And fortunately, he helped me out, and we actually wrote to the British Medical Journal whether we were allowed to write an editorial, and we were, and actually that was published. So within the space of, let's say, a few months, I had two pieces published in the English literature, and by the way, in the BMJ, so I was very proud of that.
That's very young to start a journey, Joost. I don't think so any of us are so fortunate these days. It's not easy. So anyway, moving on, Joost, I just want to know your personal views on academic publishing. I mean, I want to know what's the value or the importance of that as per your opinion. Because at the end of the day, I feel as doctors, we're trained to serve our patients and, you know, be excellent clinicians. Where does publishing fit into the life of a doctor treating patients?
Well, I think that you as a physician should have access to the most recent science that is out there that helps you to improve the management of the patient. And given the era that we are in currently, the developments are so quickly following each other. So I think you as a physician or as a researcher should be able to have access to that that information. And if you look to it, I think science in its pure form is communication from the source, whether it's the knowledge is being generated, to the target. We as physicians who actually use clinical research and outcomes of clinical research in order to optimize care of our patients.
So that's good, Jos. Just before we move on to the sort of core of the discussion, I just want to touch upon a brief overview on sort of simple terms such as, you know, impact factor or citation index, altmetric. I just want to know what the basics of these mean and what's your own take and what do they mean actually in the grand scheme of things?
Well, yeah, we as humans actually like to rank stuff. What is better? I mean, whether it boils down to soccer or the Eurovision Song Festival, and also journals we like to rank. So for that, many years ago, somebody came up with the journal impact factor. And the journal impact factor is a very easy measure that calculates the frequency with which the average article in a journal is being cited in a particular year. So for a journal impact factor of, let's say, 2, you need to have each article needs to be cited 4 times over a course of 2 years. So, and I think that is the most common, well-used measure of a journal. And mind you, this calculation is being calculated in a company, Clarivate, that is actually a commercial company. And that brings out the journal impact factor every year. So every year, a new ranking is being made.
And according to you, having a high impact factor, does it mean it's the papers published in that journal are better? What's your opinion on these rankings?
I think it's loosely correlated. For sure, journals with a better impact factor attract articles that have a bigger impact in clinical science or have a bigger impact on clinical care. But like I said, there is a loose correlation with respect to the impact factor and the quality of the journal, and in particular, the quality of the paper that is being published there. For example, if you take a look at the type of articles that attract a lot of citations, that is contributing to the impact factor, mostly are guidelines. And guidelines, I don't say that they are good or bad, but they are needed in order to improve our care. But they are citation magnets. So that's why journals actually like to publish these guidelines. But is that constitute a real science that really drives improvements? I'm not sure.
So loosely correlated. So that's a good take-home message, I think. Just want to move on to the first steps in the journey of an author, let's say, done my research, I've completed writing my paper and want to publish this. How do I start? Can you give us some tips for the authors? Do I need to actually target a journal before I start writing my paper, or should I write my paper and then target a journal? And how do I set my bar right in terms of depending on the quality of my research?
A very good question, Pradeep. I like that. But with respect to doing research, I mean, it all boils down to the same simple question. What is the question that you actually want the answer to? What does you really want to know? I mean, I see as an editor-in-chief many papers, and many of those papers are actually asking a relevant question or a question with an obvious answer that everybody knows before. So I think that the question that you ask is pivotal. It really determines the quality of the work that follows. And from a question actually follows a hypothesis. What are you going to test? And from that hypothesis leads to methodology. And it's really important that you choose the methodology right. Give me your example of duodenal adenomas. You collected a great cohort of patients with adenomas, and that's fine. But you have to realize that that is only a cohort that gives observational data that does not do an intervention. So you can only describe what you see and you cannot describe what you actually do.
Yeah. I guess, most of us do the mistake of kind of collecting some data out there and churning out some results and then ask a question. So that's probably the wrong way to do a research, and it's always a question first and then the methodology as you alluded to.
Well, even then, I mean, you can make a mistake. So let me give you an example of a study that we recently published that is in autoimmune hepatitis, where we compared two drug options. And we had the idea many years ago, and we actually started to write a protocol. But at that time, I realized that I was a novice in this field in autoimmune hepatitis. And in order to get some traction for the idea, I wrote to some of the experts in the field and asking them, I have this idea. This is the mini protocol. Do you have criticism? How can we actually improve our thinking? And how we can actually improve the rigorousness and robustness of the clinical trial? And I have to say, I was happy that I got good comments. And that really was essential in order to kickstart this whole journey.
Yes, I just want to move on to the next stage. I have written a paper and chosen my journal that I need to submit to. I've pitched it appropriately, and I get the first response from the first journal you submit your paper to, and you get that sinking feeling, you know, you get that rejection, and they say, oh, you need to make some significant revision. We've rejected it now for now, unless you make that big revision. And by this time, I guess the authors would have spent so much time writing these papers, and a lot of us give up at this stage, and it's overwhelming. It was certainly from me, and this is the stage where I froze and I said, okay, fine, I'll never do this again. Are there any tips or any of your wise words about these budding authors? What do they do at that stage? How to tackle that situation?
I realized that whenever I push the button and write a reject note, it's always difficult. And I've had the comments that I should not send out reject letters on Saturday evening or on Sunday morning, which I take for granted. But anyways, I mean, what time of the day or which day you actually get your rejection note, it's always, I would say, horrible. To be honest, I think after reject, my advice would be to read it, sit, think, and wait. Don't respond immediately. Share your message with your authors, because science is a group process. That's something you do with a team. And with a team, you share successes and you celebrate successes, but also you have to cope with, let's say, rejections. And in particular, do not immediately respond and send an inflammatory message to me. I mean, it's fine. I can handle that, having read all kinds of stuff. I mean, publication in a journal is a success of the author, and a rejection is because of the editor. Well, maybe that's not completely true, but you see where I get. And then I'm pretty serious about read your rejection note. I will give you an example. We had worked on a paper quite long for 2 or 3 years, and finally we sent it off to a journal, and it came a few weeks later back to us. And my coworker read the mail that stated, we regret that your manuscript was not accepted for publication in its current form. And he stopped reading further. So he binned the message, actually, and I thought, oh, this is the end of the world. It's being rejected. I cannot do anything. And he wanted to submit to a different journal. But after he shown the message to us, it said, well, although the review was encouraging, concerns were raised, and we ask you for revision. So it was not a reject, but helpful for us to reach out and to rewrite the paper and getting back to the journal where it was eventually published. So that's also, I think, a cool story.
Yes, let's go to the other side of the story where, yeah, you've tried, you've revised and sent it back, and you've pitched it to the right journal, and you've tried 2 or 3 journals, and still things get rejected. You feel whatever the new knowledge you've generated is still very relevant. It still deserves a place in the knowledge of the clinicians or the patients. You know, how do you spread that knowledge, or how do you take things further?
Well, rest assured, there's always a home for a good paper. But I agree. I mean, yes, Joost has his rejections too. And yes, sometimes that happens with me, that you, for the 8th or the 9th time, sent a cover letter and the paper to a different journal. But in the end, you can achieve and you can have success. But I think if you get a rejection, let's say 2-3 times, ask yourself, is the question that I asked in the paper still relevant? Is the message newsworthy? And in order to do so, just go to a colleague, an expert, and, well, show him the data, says, how can I actually go about this? How can I actually show this to the outside world and publish it? To give another example, we got a hard reject from a journal. We had done a very, I would say, very interesting observation. But they wrote back to us, it's interesting. We don't want to have it at this time because you need to expand the data points. You need to have a larger data source in order to prove your point. If you have that in 6 months, please come back to us. If not, seek a different platform. So we went back to work, and that the data that was being collected was quite precious and difficult to get. So I think if you get such an advice, please do so, because then you probably are in a good way.
Earlier you were saying science is about generating new knowledge and disseminating and probably ensuring that it reaches the right people. Let's say you're successful and managed to publish in a decent peer-reviewed journal, good peer-reviewed journal, such as the UG Journal. And you're happy, you're very elated, but not all of us read journals regularly. In fact, I personally feel most of us don't. And I feel no point in doing a research if it cannot be used, if it cannot reach the people it's intended to reach, who can use that knowledge to improve the lives of our patients. Anything the authors can do, or anything the journal's editors like you will do to spread this knowledge outside, let's say, publishing it in the journal. Is there any other way to do that?
Yeah, sure, there is. You should make noise. You should talk about your work and spread the knowledge yourself. I mean, in this current time, we have access to social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, and that those are perfect platforms in order to spread your knowledge. For the UEG Journal, for example, we use infographics that really capture the idea of a research study in one visual abstract. And that's helpful to show on Twitter or Instagram, for that matter, but also on LinkedIn, which has become en vogue as a nice social media platform. So I think there's a possibility. Secondly, I think talking about your study on the international platforms, such as the Week, the UEG Week, I think is a great option to be able to be invited to this type of options. So the DUG podcast is really cool, I think. And that helps to reach an audience that is not totally into journals. So I think those are actually the options that you can use.
So like the UEG Journal podcast, so there are podcasts from every journal, I guess, who highlight the most important science published on them, I'm assuming. And how often is the UEG Journal podcast released?
We try to do that on a monthly basis. It's a less frequent than that. But I think for the authors, it really gives an opportunity to reach out and to target a population that is listening to the podcast, and also to repackage the knowledge that you actually gained. I think this is quite relevant. And it forces you as an author to think, how can I make my case and how can I bring my message across in a different format?
Yeah, I think the infographics I really like. I think we have such a short attention span. So we anything that we read, we probably focus on it for a couple of minutes and then we kind of move on to the next topic. So that's why I feel the infographics make a massive difference to gaining knowledge, I feel. That's what I think.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's just encapsulates the major message that your paper actually has. So as an author, I think it's also really cool if you write a paper, think of what is the message that I really want to convey to the audience.
Yes, I just want to sort of broach on a bit of controversial issue here. And let's say, you know, you put in a lot of effort to come to some new research. Let's say you found out some new technique to remove a polyp or new technique to do a traction on some ESD, and you want to spread that knowledge. And let's say you don't have the skill set, or you just find it very daunting to try and publish this and make a video or make science out of it and publish it. Why can't the authors just spread the knowledge on social media, for example, and other places, rather than trying to publish scientifically in scientific journals?
Yeah, I see that threshold is much lower in order to publish in on Twitter or on LinkedIn. And that's a cool feature, I have to say. I mean, if you want to publish in a New England Journal of Medicine, that starts with headache and ends with an headache. So that's quite difficult. But the major element here is credibility. Because with a journal, you buy reputation, you buy credibility. If you publish something in, let's say, gastroenterology or in Lancet gastroenterology and hepatology, then everybody knows it has a seal of approval from the journal, from peer reviewers, and is probably as close to the truth as you possibly can get. While if you see something on social media or a different website, then you really don't know whether it's actually true and can be used. I mean, there are many examples also from the device industry where somebody has a very good idea. It's very logical. It's very intuitive to use. And then it's being used in clinical practice. The first cases go well and generate a lot of noise. But on really close look and seeing all complications there, it's a different story.
That's true. I guess most of us clinicians rely on guidelines. And when it comes to writing the guidelines, the only evidence that's taken is the one that's properly published. And I guess you miss out on that, using that knowledge in a proper way.
Yeah, peer review acts as a filter and I think serves as a quality tool with all the limitations actually that it has.
Yeah, it's worth the extra effort. Yes, I want to talk about accessing these papers once they're published. You know, from a clinician's perspective, I come from this side of the room mainly, and I'm amazed by the demands to pay for articles. You know, when I try to click on a paper, try to access it, and click on the link, and then it says, oh, $29.99 to access this paper. I mean, it's like going to a high street shop, really, and I feel very cringy about these things. I mean, you know, why do we have to pay so much money to access our own work, or my colleague's work, or your work, for example? I personally can access this through my institution, but not all of us have the luxury. And some of my colleagues just give up and they say, okay, fine, I can't access it, forget about it. So are there any ways, what are your perspectives on this and how do you think things are changing in the future?
Well, the situation you describe is actually a poster child for what is happening here in the current world. Because writing an article and getting your message out, publishing, is the perfect example of a collision between business world and academia. Because we as authors and as users of the knowledge, we get paid by the NHS, for example, in your situation, or government in my situation. And the knowledge that we generate is being paid by taxpayers. And then again, we have to pay to get our research published, which is mind-boggling, I would say. But you have to realize that somebody has to pay for the knowledge and access to the knowledge. And I think an open access system where an author pays for the open access and the author should be reimbursed through grants or the government, that's probably the best option. Because if you look to the subscriber model, if you're not a subscriber to a journal, you don't have access unless you are able to find it through the library of your university. And then the library should have a subscription, which costs money. So it's a difficult situation, I think. And we as, let's say, end users are not used to this collision of academia and business. But we should be very aware of that.
Yes, I just want to deviate from publishing here a little bit and talk about editors and reviewers. I just want to know how younger generation, let's say you've done the author bit, you've published 3 or 4 papers, and you want to take that first step as being the editor, or at least just a step of a reviewer first, I guess, and then the editor, like a journey to the top. And maybe you can explain with your own journey how what opportunities exist for our younger generation, how they can get onto this ladder.
Well, let me give you the example of the UEG journal. Now, maybe you can expand to different other journals as well, but let's focus on the UEG journal first. what we did is, when I started my tenure as an editor-in-chief, is to invite young and upcoming clinicians, gastroenterologists, basic scientists, to be part of the venture that I was doing with the UEG journal, and to become a trainee editors. We have now a set of 15 trainee editors who have a whole array of jobs, from search engine optimization, creating visual abstracts, peer reviewing, helping to write articles, helping to analyze articles. So I think that's a really nice start for somebody who wants a career, or at least a sidekick within the industry. So this is really an easy way to have access. And of course, you can get there through peer review. You ask your boss, your mentor, your colleagues, whether they have access to articles that need to be peer reviewed. So you get a little, little experience, and whether you like it or not.
How do you choose your reviewers then in the journal? Do you just invite them randomly based on their publication? And is there any way of remunerating the reviewers in terms of their time and effort?
We use the trainee editors to review some pieces, but in general, I personally use my close network in order to review papers. So I get to see quick results from the reviewing process. So that's what the way I use it. Do we remunerate the peer reviewers? No, we don't do that at this point in time. And I see difficulties there as well. Maybe in the future that is going to change as well.
Okay. Just moving on to collaboration used in terms of, working solo or within your smaller group, or would you collaborate with various people outside your institute, for example? What are the advantages of doing that? I'm not just talking in terms of publication. I'm talking in terms of research as well, conducting research. And are there any challenges in doing this, and any practical tips on how to find collaborators? What's your view on that?
In my view, single center studies are something, a thing of the past. It's cool if you want to do this. You can have absolute control over the data. You can go as deep as you really want, and you can have a nice set of data, and you can describe it very well and as an institute. But the situation in your institute may be wildly different from that of your neighbor in the same city, or two cities away, or even a country away. So if you think that the outcome of your single center study is relevant and important, please check out with your colleagues elsewhere and replicate the findings. And there are multiple reasons to do so. First of all, I think you will have much better, robust results. And secondly, Pradeep, it's much more fun to work in a team.
Definitely. We know that.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the end, if you have success, you can celebrate that with the whole team and maybe go out for something, for a party. The thing is, not only that you celebrate as a team, but after you had a nice result, you can implement the result in multiple cities just on the same instant. And I think that's also where you want your research to be used.
We need to start winding down this episode. Thanks for such an enlightening discussion. I think you come from both sides of the table here, as an author and as also as an editor. And thanks for giving us your viewpoint from both sides of the table. I think it's very enlightening, certainly for me. And I think we've probably, hopefully, touched upon most of the aspects of the evolving landscape within the field of scientific publishing. To conclude, how do you see the ideal future, or maybe your vision of publishing and access to science in the future for both, from the perspective of authors, the clinicians, and the journals? Is there a fine balance between everything?
Yeah, I think collaboration is key in order to get the best answers. And secondly, use and reuse from data that is already out there and has been generated. UK Biobank is a great example. But I think that there are many other examples of data sets that are being created and can be reused for different purposes.
Excellent. Yes, thanks for spending that extra time on a Friday evening. I hope you have this weekend off and get to spend time with your family and friends. Thanks ever so much for your time and effort.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers.